At last year's New Zealand election, the centre-right National Party won something like 7 to 8% more votes than the opposition Labor Party. But the government was unable to secure a coalition deal with that kingmaker, Winston Peters. His New Zealand First Party held the balance of power in line with New Zealand's German-style mixed-member proportional system. I won't start explaining it now, it's too complicated. Well, that party shocked the political establishment in Wellington by backing Labor and its young and charismatic leader, Jacinda Ardern. Now, to get an update from across the Tasman, let's turn to Oliver Hartwich. He's from the New Zealand Initiative. Oliver, welcome back to RN.
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you.
Now, from 2008 to last year, the governments of John Key and Bill English, they delivered budget surpluses, consistent 3% economic growth, 4.8% unemployment rate. Why did New Zealand's Conservatives lose office?
Well, as you said, they delivered competent government, they delivered broadly good economic figures, and yet they were a third-term government, and typically in New Zealand after three terms, the people feel that it's kind of time for a change and to give a new party a chance to run affairs. And admittedly, there were a few things where National didn't deliver. So if you look at the state of the New Zealand housing market, or you look at some water quality issues, some people said, oh, actually, we could do a bit better, so maybe it is time for a change.
And you've argued elsewhere that meanwhile, Jacinda Ardern, she's sort of eerily similar to Kevin from Brisbane 10 years ago.
Well, she was similar to Kevin Rudd in some ways, because if you remember Kevin Rudd's campaign in 2007, he didn't promise a big break with the past. He also promised gradual improvements and presented himself as a fiscal conservative. So he didn't really promise to completely upset the political scene, but just to do some things a little bit better. And in that sense, there was a parallel to Jacinda Ardern's campaign last year. On other issues, I think there are not that many parallels between Kevin Rudd and Jacinda Ardern personally, because so far I've never really met anyone who really despises Jacinda Ardern.
Right, well, but her critics would say that at least Rudd had some exposure to high-level politics. You know, he'd been a senior diplomat, he worked as Wayne Goss's right-hand man, had been in Parliament for 10 years. I mean, is Ardern's relative lack of exposure to high-level politics, to what extent is that a handicap?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think even Kevin Rudd didn't hold any elected office before he became Prime Minister, and neither did Jacinda Ardern, but she had been a Member of Parliament for a few years. She had worked in Britain in the Department of Prime Minister. So she
Tony Blair, right?
And she was, of course, working for a previous New Zealand Prime Minister, Helen Clark. So it is not to say that Jacinda was inexperienced. She didn't have experience in government as an elected minister. But of course, she was experienced because she had been part of the political class of New Zealand for quite some time.
Well, let's turn to the question men never get asked.
What exactly is the date the baby's due?
The 17th of June.
The 17th. It's interesting how much people have been counting back to the conception, as it were.
Really?
Well, having produced six children, it doesn't amaze me that people can have children. Why shouldn't a child be conceived during an election campaign?
Well, I mean...
Yes, that was Charles Woolley on 60 Minutes interrogating the New Zealand Prime Minister. Tell us about the controversy over Jacinda Ardern's pregnancy, and to what extent is she now seen in New Zealand, now more than ever, a trendsetter for women around the world, given those types of questions?
Well, when you listen to interviews like the ones that you just played, it of course makes you cringe, because we shouldn't be asking these questions in 2018. And it would be tempting to say, well, only an Australian interviewer would ask these questions. But in fact, we've had exactly the same debate in New Zealand, of course, and she was asked the same questions when she became leader of the opposition. But I think we have to put the whole thing into context here. Jacinda became deputy leader of her party early last year. And at that time, of course, people were speculating, would she take the leadership of the Labour Party eventually? And so she was asked these questions. And I think to dodge the question and to not seem illoyal to her party leader, she said, look, I want to have children. I want to have a family at one stage. And maybe I'm not quite ready. So don't even ask me that question. And then half a year later, suddenly, out of nowhere, she became party leader because her party leader resigned. And that's when people then said, well, actually, half a year ago, you told us you weren't ready to be leader because you wanted to have children and family. And now you're leader. So what does that actually mean? So in a way, she kind of brought that question on herself, and she admitted as much in interviews later. and said, well, I can understand why you're asking the questions, because I actually said I wasn't quite ready to be leader because of that, but you shouldn't ask any other women these questions. And I think that's probably the background you have to take into account when you're discussing these questions.
Fascinating. No, well, I don't think many Australians know that history. Oliver, one big issue on the New Zealand campaign trail had been immigration, and some say it helps explain why Winston Peters supported Jacinda Ardern for PM. Now, New Zealand Labor, a bit like Tony Abbott here, it's odd they're on different sides of politics, but they say cutting immigration is essential for citizens' quality of life because it's reducing the demand for the overheated property market. Is that plausible?
Well, first of all, on Winston Peters, I wouldn't overplay this. I think Winston Peters wanted to be part of the government, and some actual policy issues mattered a little bit less than that.
Yeah, but he's been a long-time supporter for slashing immigration, correct?
Well, that's true, but it's just one of the issues on which he sometimes runs rather populist campaigns. For Labour, I think the realisation was just that New Zealanders were rightly concerned about the level of house prices, and it was just an easy kind of scapegoating exercise, singling out the level of immigration. And actually, admittedly, migration figures are quite high in New Zealand at the moment. We are currently running a migration surplus of about 70,000 people a year, which is quite a significant number in a country as small as New Zealand. And it's a change from the past when migration track records with New Zealand, especially vis-a-vis Australia, were not nearly as positive as they are today. So I think that was realised by the Labour campaign, and therefore they ran a campaign focusing extremely on the housing market and then linking it to some migration issues, while never really committing themselves to a complete target, because I think even during the campaign, Labour realised that promising a precise figure of net migration intake would have been unrealistic, because no government has the ability to really fine-tune migration numbers to that detail.
And you've argued that immigration cuts, they'll stunt economic growth, right?
Well, you would have to ask, where would you actually start with these cuts? Because there are some categories that you wouldn't want to cut and some other categories that you simply can't cut. So you can't cut the number of New Zealanders and Australians moving to New Zealand, because they've got a right to reside here, and their families, of course, as well. Then there are some migrants coming as students, and we know that our New Zealand universities need their students' fees, these students' fees, and that is factored in, so you wouldn't really want to cut there either. And then, of course, we have skills shortages in our economy, and they're well documented, and you can talk to any New Zealand business and they will tell you how difficult it is to find staff, qualified staff. So you really wouldn't want to cut there either. So really, bringing down migration figures from a current net intake of 70-odd thousand people a year is a difficult task, and maybe not even a desirable one. And I think the Labour government, now that they are in government, they have realised it, and they have actually backtracked on their rhetoric from the election campaign.
Amazing. Well, we're having very similar debates here across the Tasman. Now, sticking with immigration, or at least refugees, a few months ago, Ardern said she did not regard the plight of those detainees on Manus Island and Nauru as acceptable. She's not alone there. And she pledged to take 150 of them. She was widely hailed across many of refugee activists in this country. But how serious should we take a position? Because my understanding is New Zealand accepts only 750 refugees every year. Australia takes something like 14,000 annually.
I think your understanding is correct. That figure, the 750 intake a year, might actually go up to about 1,000. But even on that new level, we would still be below Australia's levels.
Per capita wise, yes.
Per capita wise, definitely. But also in absolute terms, of course. So I think what you heard from the Prime Minister on the refugee question was a little bit of, well, domestic political posturing. And of course, for any New Zealand government, this is quite easy to talk about refugees, because Australia simply faces a different refugee problem compared to New Zealand, because we are a bit further away from the hotspots from which migrants and refugees arrive. And it's far easier to reach Australia, of course, by boat than it would be to reach New Zealand. So I think New Zealand is actually free riding a little bit on the Australian Defence Force's efforts to stop refugees coming to Australia.
Okay, but what about that official tour of the Polynesian region? I think she went to Tonga and Samoa, as well as the self-governing nations in free association with New Zealand, Cook Islands, for example. Now, this was her first visit to the region since becoming PM. What's the message here?
Welland was announced and celebrated as a so-called Pacific reset. So New Zealand tries to re-establish connections in the region, in the wider Pacific. You probably have to see this whole exercise in the context of China's influence in the region. So China has been very active providing assistance, development assistance, loans to a number of these Pacific nations. And New Zealand certainly doesn't want to be forgotten and wants to re-establish itself as a power in that region.
So the Pacific is now a contested space with China. On that note, what about this possible Chinese interference? Because I understand that Ardern will be asking questions and taking action if evidence proves that a recent break-in into the house of, I think it was a professor at the University of Canterbury, who's an expert on foreign interference, she's wondering if it, in any way that's proven that's related to a foreign power. Now, if that's true, do you expect New Zealand agencies to be able to get to the bottom of the break-in, and what will they do then?
Well, I would expect agencies to get to the bottom of it. I'm not sure whether the public would understand what they found out. So far, we have seen a few headlines around that incident. It occurred to a professor who took some very critical views regarding China and Chinese.
A bit like the Clive Hamilton of New Zealand, if you like.
Indeed, indeed. And we will have to see what comes out of this and what will be officially revealed. My impression is that Australia is perhaps 2 or 3 years advanced on that debate on Chinese influence in domestic affairs, and New Zealand is probably headed for a very similar debate as well.
That's Oliver Hartwich. He's Executive Director of the New Zealand Initiative in Wellington.